You're listening to Rowan Radio On Demand. Download more podcasts at rowanradio.com.
The following program does not represent the views or opinions of the staff or administration of Rowan University or Rowan Radio, 89.7 WGLS FM.
Now, Rowan Radio, 89.7 WGLS FM presents Writers Roundtable. This show features writers and poets sharing their ideas and experiences with the art of writing. And now here's your host, Rowan University professor Ron Block.
Welcome to Writers Roundtable. Today we're going to hear South Jersey poet John Watowitz read from his work for a publication reading of the latest issue of Glassworks magazine. Glassworks is published by the Master of Arts and Writing program at Rowan University, which is in the Department of Writing Arts. The reading, held at Rowan Art Gallery, also featured graduate students reading poems and stories published in the latest issue of Glassworks, as well as the poet Elizabeth Sunflower. Here is John Watowitz, introduced by graduate student Ann Caputo.
I'm Ann Caputo, and I am a nonfiction editor this fall for Glassworks magazine. John Catfish Watowitz has a passion for bonfires, boots, and bluegrass, and most especially, poetry. This may have something to do with the fact that he grew up on his family's azalea and rhododendron farm. Currently a mental health coordinator for a local community college, John still manages to spend time in the wilderness when he can. His poetry has been published in Steamboat, Naugatuck River Review, and Driftwood, to name a few, and most recently, Glassworks Magazine. And he is with us tonight. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce you to John Watowitz.
How's it going? This is a very nice atmosphere for this kind of thing. We have the Willy Wonka wallpaper over there. It's really, can we get that? My fiance's here. No? Okay. I'm going to start out with the poem published in Glassworks. Flipping horseshoe crabs in Fortescue. She bent down every few feet to flip over the ones upended by the tide, left exposed to the red knot gulls. Her eyes were still blue in moonlight, with the shadow of her dark hair creating an eclipse every time it fell in her face. We met a couple beers in a bonfire ago as she wandered off, strolled the beach, raised by the tide, not washed away in it. Horseshoe crabs are old-fashioned, preferring to mate at night during high tides, new and full moons. She silently showed me how to flip them from the side, avoid injuring the tail. Watch her scuttle back to the Delaware Bay. 400 million years, the species has fumbled like Charlie Brown, heels overhead, guided by instinct in May-June moonlight. Surviving ice ages, meteor strikes, mass extinctions, the rifting of Pangaea by engaging their ancient lunar ritual. I followed her unspoken hand in cotton skin, picking the rhythm of the tide, burrowing into the sand at the mercy of waves. And going along with that kind of nautical theme is this next one, Astronomy Lesson. I met a mermaid who drank St. Pauli Girl and smoked Marlboro Lights at a floating tiki bar near Treasure Island. We discussed the benefits of coastal living, and she highlighted with starfish pink lips how solid ground weakens storms. I described the reddish hurricane hues of a never-ending tempest trapped in a landless liquid hydrogen ocean on Jupiter. She asked if I was a man of the stars, batting aquamarine eyes while flipping an emerald-scale tail enticingly. I took her back to see my boat's telescope, poured her a cranberry vodka before showing off the swirl of the largest storm in the solar system. Into the mystic, drifted across an old zenith transoceanic shortwave as she removed her scallop shells for a night swim. We dived into a reflection of stars, colliding against the natural current with a splash like crosswinds at the great red spot. She stayed entwined in my arms until sunrise, wetting herself when necessary through a hinged access hatch. I whispered a want for her to be mine, hinted an intent for her father to let me take her hand, but she giggled at my early morning masculinity. She was daughter only to the tide, and advised to be more attuned to the feminine winds brewing within the cosmos as she lit a cigarette and cracked my last beer. So we're talking about the tides and waves, so I can't do that without reading a couple poems about the moon. So this one was actually nominated for a pushcart prize, so here's to hoping. Laying by the lake. A grapefruit moon subtly reminds him of the solar neighborhood as he straps a hammock around dense pines locally grown on Earth. He settles a goose-down sleeping bag into it and pulls a harmonica out of somewhere, humming Mr. Tambourine Man after a long day of hopping southbound trains. It's his father's birthday who helped him come out of this world, so he thinks about a fireplace, scratchy Dylan records. An underwater orange orb seems about to surface, pummeled to perfection by otherworldly asteroids. He nestles near one of its craters and sings the trees to sleep. This one was inspired by my daughter, Aubrey, over there. I said when I started collecting these kids, that I wouldn't write, I'm not going to become one of those poets who writes about their kids, but I think it's inevitable, so here we are. Mr. Moon. The moon is following me, Mama, she concludes from the back seat, while kicking her feet, as these are the only extremities that her car seat allows full range of motion. The shoulder straps pull tight against her belly button, securing her like an umbilical cord did when her mother's stomach was swollen like the sun, uterus and nucleus, milk-hardened breasts, asteroids in orbit. She believes the moon is now caught in her infectious pull as well. I can't argue its power, so I just nod and smile. The solution to most enigmatic moments, like when people assert, "She has your blue eyes, young man," without knowing they're staring into different pools, or when they exclaim, "What an adorable little family," as we walk past, hands locked in line, never realizing I am but an alien within a purely maternal solar system. "Do you think Mr. Moon will come home with us, Daddy?" I look back, seeing her as I've always known her, with blonde hair both uncouth and uncut, and say yes, because somehow I know he's just another wandering body, formed somewhere else in this empty expanse of rock and space, captured by Earth's gravity, while passing close beside. Here's another poem Aubrey makes an appearance in. This is my day after the 2016 election poem. So, silver lining. The morning a megalomaniac won the election, I took down the flag that hung above my bed. I felt as if I should place it, carefully folded, into a casket, like the ones it had so often been draped over in the wake of similar ego-driven organisms. After my little girl woke up, we took a walk on the streets of Harper's Ferry and heard a man singing a cold and broken hallelujah. He winked at me as I had my daughter put a dollar in his guitar case, and I realized some things were sacrosanct, like love and Leonard Cohen songs. My greatest weapon against tyranny had pigtails and was holding my hand. I reminded her that girls were not less than boys, and that different shades of skin didn't mean different shades of souls. As we went home, we tried to avoid stepping on sidewalk cracks and picked wildflowers. Together, we hung Old Glory back up over my bed. Well, speaking of spooky days, Halloween's coming up. If you haven't figured out, I'm a fan of that holiday. So I'm going to read a couple spooky poems. This one was actually written in a workshop with R.G. Evans, who's a, I think, faculty here. I was lucky enough to have him as my high school teacher. So, big props to him. He's teaching a workshop tonight down in Bridgeton, so we'll forgive him for missing it. But to whoever has my voodoo doll, whenever you get tired of tripping me with my own shoelaces and spilling coffee on my shirt, could you scratch that incessant itch on the square of my back? Or is that you too? I still have a migraine from yesterday, which I assume you spent flicking my head over and over. How about a sensual massage for once? A foot rub? Maybe somewhere in that shoebox where you keep miniature me next to tufts of other people's hair, you've got a female doll. Could you lie her on top of me? It's been a while. You can't be a piney without having a bluegrass Jersey Devil poem, so here's mine. Bluegrass fiend. See, Satan listens to Black Sabbath and good old rock and roll, but deep in the pine barrens, down where the cranberries grow, the devil prefers Bill Monroe. This devil doesn't play a fiddle strung with angel hair, but a banjo plucked between swigs of cognac on back roads and porches, a different sort of man in black. With a pork pie hat over his horns and wings worn as a vest tucked over his tail, he frequents Albert Hall and other South Jersey honky-tonks, stomping through the doors like a Clydesdale. He doesn't pay the cover, and you can't interest him in a crockpot hot dog with sauerkraut, but if you brought your goat, he'll suck its life right out. The Jersey Devil's not much for dancing, but Dolly Parton he adores. And if someone plays Jolene, you'll hear fur-lined hooves with spurs scuffing up refinished floors. It's that high and lonesome sound that ignites his piney pride, sparks his heart of coal. Some nights he even sits in with the headlining act, exhaling hand-rolled cigarettes like a smokestack. I'll do one more of those from personalizing some of my favorite, I don't want to say mythical creatures, real creatures that you just haven't seen. Bigfoot gets on the grid. When the court decides he was human enough to stand trial, the National Resource Defense Council took his case pro bono. They bought him a suit from Men's Warehouse, trimmed his whiskers, slicked back his hair, until he resembled Beast from the X-Men comics of his youth. Bigfoot testified how his father was billed as Monkey Man, Darwin's missing link in a traveling freak show, along with his bearded mother, dubbed Lady Lionface. He described receiving beatings when he struggled, learning to juggle, how he escaped into the forest, shunning what they considered an honest living. He pled the fifth to all charges, including thefts of countless chickens and livestock, claiming a diet mostly of high-brush blueberries and ringneck pheasants. All the jury could find him guilty of was trespassing due to questionable eyewitness accounts and lack of clear video evidence. Bigfoot completed 80 hours of community service conducting scared straight seminars with local runaways before reveling in his newfound societal acceptance. He reunited with his parents on Oprah, dated a Victoria's Secret model turned on by his rugged looks, and did ads for L.L. Bean, Patagonia, and REI. However, going from occasional National Enquirer cameos to the front page of the New York Times had put him back on display for a living. The woods beckoned. He turned down the role of Chewbacca in a new Star Wars film and bought 20 acres in the Catskills with a cabin and private lake, spending his days fishing off a little Coleman crawdad with a two-stroke Mercury motor, retiring at sunset to meditate under the tranquil trees of evening. So my mom's here tonight, over here. Usually, I have to read in stinky bars and back alleys, so this is a big change. So I'm going to read a mom poem. Growing up, my shoes abandoned on the front stoop told my mother everything she needed to know. As she clapped them together, releasing the peaches caked on the bottoms, and shook her head, a smile crossed her face. 1305 Brazos Street, Texarkana, Texas, stained her speech. That boy was in the orchard again. I'd walk through like a blind man, feeling for large, round, semi-soft droops, and listen to the squash of fermented ones under my feet. Freeing myself from the isolation of never being alone, my mother would hear the back door click from her bed. "There he goes again," she'd tell my father. I always picked the fruit straight off the tree, to be the one that stressed the branch, broke off the fruit, bit into the soft skin, and tasted its sweet insides was the pleasure of having something grow just for you. Sometimes to meet up with my girl, moonlight was always better than the movies.
The orchard's foliage covered my presence from passing cars and nearby neighbors. I'd get some local boys together and have bonfires right there in the orchard, burning branches that weren't ours and boundaries. Only my mother suspected I was crossing. So here's a poem inspired by a news article I read. Most people don't know, but the flamingos at the Cape May Zoo used to belong to Michael Jackson. They were, I guess they won the bid for those. So this poem is entitled, just like the news article, Cape May County Zoo receives 13 Chilean flamingos from Neverland Ranch. The King of Pop's flamingos look like typical tropical wading birds, long legs with backward bending knees and seemingly superfluous feathers, pigmented pink from their diet of crustaceans. As a kid, I ate nothing but sweet potatoes and pumpkin pie the week following Thanksgiving and turned orange. The same week, Thriller burst into my parents' living room, breaking MTV's color barrier. I'm not sure if it was the guidance of a white-gloved hand or the four joints I smoked in the parking lot, basking in the haze of overindulgence, but something was particular about how these flamingos shifted weight from one leg to the other. The sign in front of the flamingo yard noted they devote considerable time before, during, and after breeding to collective displays, with most flocks performing slight variations of the same synchronized movements. This ensemble's twist preen resembled a side slide with wing legs stretched like an anti-gravity lean, and their wing salute mimicked a crotch grab as they collectively marched in an unmistakable moonwalk. I sprained my arm over Christmas break, attempting to imitate MJ's moves, back before adulthood's chill whispered that Peter Pan didn't have bills to pay, leading me to re-enter childhood only occasionally, with world of birds security shrieking for me to stay on my side of the fence. So I don't actually ride a motorcycle, but I do in poems. It's a lot safer that way. So this starts out with an epigraph from Woody Guthrie's autobiography, Bound for Glory. I've been lying to myself for a good long time now, saying I didn't want no little house and all of that. Security deposit. He played the Birds' Ballad of Easy Rider on repeat at the housewarming, in effigy to a path of threadbare days and foxhole prayers, having given up his 88 Softail Springer and faded Merle Haggard t-shirt for the woman waking up in it. He bought the bike to shake off roots that grew like vines on back roads with names like Buck Shoot 'em and Quail Run, departing to ride the Blue Ridge, rhododendrons in bloom, with just a hammock and Mexican blanket, before bearing west, unsure of destination. He kept on to California, met a girl who kept him calm between the morning smile of a red thong and freewheeling fantasies of Neil Young's Unknown Legend. When her slender frame started showing, they headed back to his South Jersey hometown, trekking through an ever-changing net of starlight, stopping to climb Tinicum Lighthouse and watch planes settle into sun-soaked sky before hawking the Harley for a safe place to land. Thank you.
We've been listening to John Witowitz read his poetry at the publication reading for the Rowan University literary magazine Glassworks, published by the MA in Writing Program in the Department of Writing Arts. When we return, we'll hear John Witowitz answer a few questions from the audience. Welcome back to Writers Roundtable. We've been listening to John Witowitz read his poetry at the publication reading for the Rowan University literary magazine Glassworks, published by the MA in Writing Program in the Department of Writing Arts. At the end of the reading, there was time for questions from the audience.
My name is Anthony Palma. I'm the managing editor of Glassworks. One of the things that always interests me about writing is how where we're from or how our surroundings influence our work. So how do you feel where you're from or where you are now affects the work you do? Does it find its way in your work? I mean, does it affect your process?
I think it absolutely makes its way into my work, because anything you love, anything you hate, and
it drifts in. But and I love where I'm from, and I love South Jersey, and I think that writing poems about, I mean, that's what I know. You know, they say write what you know, write what you're an expert on. And I mean, I'm pretty much an expert on South Jersey, I would say. So I think it does. It definitely, I mean, even my poem, you know, Fortescue, right? It's South Jersey. So, and I take very, very, a lot of pride in talking about South Jersey. So for me, I think it definitely is a big guiding influence, you know, traveling and moving about. But I think even when I travel, I'm always like, well, this is different from South Jersey. Like, oh, you know, but that's my sounding board is like South Jersey. So I think that we're tied to each other. I'm drinking the water and I'm not leaving anytime soon. So
that was John Witowicz answering a question about his sense of place as a South Jersey poet. The next question from the audience, amplified here slightly, was about his spirit animal.
If you had a writing spirit animal that emphasized your creative style, what would it be?
A groundhog. B.J. Ward has a poem. I forget the title, but basically it's like New Jersey's like a groundhog, like this little awkward thing, just like sitting up by the side of the road, hoping not to get run over. So, you know, but groundhogs are like weird and lovely. So that's like, that's my spirit. We have a family of them living in our yard. So I like groundhogs, but they're weird. They're kind of odd shaped. And I think my poems are a little like that. So
one member of the audience asked for advice about the process of writing.
So, and I didn't make this up, but let yourself write a crappy first draft, right? Like, give yourself that permission. Because the cure to writer's block is like, we sit down and we're like, I'm going to write the great American novel. Let's go, right? And like, in that moment, you're putting all this pressure on yourself to, like, write something great. Like, give yourself permission to write something terrible. Like, I'm just going to write this. And if it's garbage, like, what? It's a poem. Write in the garbage. And then to edit. Like, editing is like, the first draft should be like a keg party. Like, everybody, like, come on in. Then, like, throughout the night, you're, like, kicking people out. Like, whoa, that's, like, somebody's underage sister. You're gone. Like, you threw up on my shoes. Like, you're out. And then you're, like, getting down to this refined thing. Like, but in the beginning, like, give yourself permission. Like, give yourself permission to get weird. Give yourself permission to, like, let everything in. And then start kicking out. And give yourself permission to just make it terrible. Because you don't most people don't start off. I mean, you know, Bob Dylan wrote "Blowing in the Wind" in 10 minutes when he was half asleep. But the rest of us, like, it's going to take us a little bit longer.
And finally, another audience member asked John Witowicz about his motivations for writing poetry and how it has affected him.
Tony Hoagland has another poem that I almost read tonight, and this is Catfish Butcher's poems. There's this part in the poem where he says, you know, there's this pigeon feather that lands on the water. And he's like, and in that moment, that's why I dog ear pages in library books, so that other people can, to show other people where to look, right? So poetry for me, like, has shown me where to look. So I'm like, wow, I should look at that sunset just a little bit longer, right? Because I'm going to write a poem about it. But even in that moment, it just puts me in that moment. Because our brains, like, I'm a social worker, so hang on. Our brains have, a negativity bias. Like, it's just built in. That's what keeps us alive. We're, like, scanning the room to make sure that, you know, everything's safe and everything's good. So when there's negative information, like, it's like Velcro for our brains. So with poetry, not even just the act of writing it, but the act of noticing it, is what brings that positivity balance to my brain. You know, like, I'm noticing it more things. So it's not even the act of writing it. It's the act of just, like, living and noticing what poetry is and that it's a living, breathing thing. And once in a while, I get my butterfly net out and I capture one and, you know, write it down. But more often than not, it's just, like, I'm noticing poetry everywhere. So it's not even the act of writing it. It's just the act of noticing that has kind of changed my outlook on things.
We've been listening to John Witowitz read his poetry at the publication reading for the Rowan University literary magazine Glassworks, published by the MA in Writing program in the Department of Writing Arts. My thanks go out to Glassworks Editor-in-Chief Katie Budris and to students in her course Editing the Literary Journal who organized the event. And thanks to all you for listening to Writers Roundtable. This is Ron Block.
You've been listening to Writers Roundtable, hosted by Rowan University professor Ron Block, on Rowan Radio, 89.7 WGLS-FM. Please join us the fourth Monday of every month for another edition of Writers Roundtable, exclusively on Rowan Radio, 89.7 WGLS-FM.